Welcome to Wired on Development Interviews. This is episode 5.
Get Wired on Development!
Today we're talking with Karen Pape, who's on a mission to start a movement with clinicians, researchers and parents that no longer settle for less than optimal rehabilitation. Karen is a neonatologist and a clinical neuroscientist who has been in this game for a long time, long enough to know that it's time for a change. In a world where there is a strong focus on accommodating disabilities rather than fixing them, she's standing up and saying, that's just not good enough. We can do better. We can do better for these kids, and these kids can grow up into adults with less pain and better function. Because baby brains do heal, and as therapists, we'd better be making the most of that neuroplasticity when it's most potent. She's been writing about how we can do this on her blog, karenpapemd.com, which is where I first came across her brilliant mind. And she's put all of her experiences in a book called The Boy Who Could Run But Not Walk. I loved reading it so much, I'm going to give away 2 copies for free. Make sure you are subscribed to the Wired on Development email list for details. I love talking with Karen. She is practical, she's smart, and she has a great way of explaining things. I hope you enjoy listening to her interview as much as I enjoyed doing it.
I wrote the book as a bit of a memoir because I was trying to figure out how I got to where I was. Because I started out, I wanted to be a vet, then I wanted to be a doctor, and that was very young. And then I thought I'd be a neurosurgeon for the longest time. And I went to McGill and did neuropsych and neurophysiology and learned a lot more about brains. And then I went into medicine, pediatrics, decided that I really didn't want to be a neurosurgeon, and they wouldn't have me anyway because there were no female neurosurgeons in that distant past days. So I went into neonatology, and, you know, to me, the study of baby brain injury and following these kids through has been my life's work, and I love it.
It was really interesting for me both reading your book and the Norman Doidge book about neuroplasticity and the, you know, the struggle that it's been to get that recognized. So really understanding how much of a battle it's been to get to this point was fascinating for me.
Well, just to make it sort of real, Edward Taub proved in the 1960s that constraint-induced movement therapy worked in strokes and it worked in children with cerebral palsy in the 1960s. Actually, proved it first in monkeys and then in adults with stroke and then with kids with CP. And the point is, you know, we have got to improve our knowledge translation and make it a whole lot faster than that.
Yeah, 1960s, wow. So how did you make the jump from vet to doctor?
I volunteered in a vet's clinic and decided. And I can remember it was a seminal moment when he told me that I would have to go to Guelph Veterinary College here in Ontario if I wanted to be a vet. And I wasn't too upset about the fact that he told me I'd have to take care of horses, but I drew a line at pigs and cows.
Oh.
I thought, you know, medicine's got to be better than this.
So you describe in that journey that you had in your book, there's a couple of aha moments for you, but which one really stands out that you'd like to share with people that are listening today?
Well, I think it's the book. It's the Boy Who Could Run But Not Walk. That was my major aha moment when I realized that children got worse. Babies, premature babies, full-term babies who had ended up having cerebral palsy had basically a limited time damage to their brain. They don't keep getting more brain damage. But as I watched them grow, and I was lucky when I ran the clinic to see a lot of them right through to adulthood, they all got worse with spasticity. And that spasticity progressed with body growth without any further damage to the brain. So when I finally realized that something was happening in the body that was causing spasticity to progress, because there was no further brain damage, that's, I think, when I first started to think about the totality of children's experience And the boy who could run but not walk was the best example of that because, you know, at the time he came into my life, I was a neonatologist and I was the brain expert. And I had gone away and done a postdoc and developed ultrasound brain scanning. And so I got to see all of these kids and I got to follow them all. And I had seen a child with a big unilateral right-sided bleed. And I very comfortably, you know, I was very happy at that time to be able to say to the parents, well, you know, he probably will have cerebral palsy, but it won't be too bad because he won't have seizures and he won't have speech problems and his leg will be worse than his arm because he was a preterm hemi. And I discharged him from the clinic with a left hemiplegia when he was about 3 because that's as far as our clinic would follow them at that time. And so then his mother phones me up and says, when he's about 7 or 8, and says he made the soccer team. So I think I've heard a couple of your webcasts, and I think it's a fairly common feeling that doctors can be relatively arrogant and narrow-minded at times. I was a perfect example because she couldn't see me because we were on the phone, but I rolled my eyeballs. Right, he's sitting on the side and keeping score because he's a bright little guy, but he's not playing soccer. And she insisted, she must have picked it up in my voice, because she insisted over and over again that he was playing soccer in a competitive league. And then finally she said to me, she said he didn't make the first cut. He made the 4th cut, the last cut, but there were kids that didn't make the team. And at that time there had been a hospital expansion, so I was in an empty old clinical ward, and I had a nice big walkway. So I made him walk up and down the hall a couple of times, and I proved to myself that he still had a left hemiplegia. And then I said, okay, now run. And hell, he ran down to the end and did a perfect pivot turn. And I was surprised because his balance was so good. And I said to myself, that's okay. That's his good leg. And so he comes tearing right back in front of me, and right in front of me, he does a perfect pivot turn on his affected left leg. And I actually said out loud, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And his mother, she's laughing. And I made him run up and down and run up and down so he was exhausted by the time I was really there. But I could not understand how he had such perfect balance, such perfect running skills, such equal stride length when he was running, and he walked with a typical moderate left hemi gait. So it took me years to figure it out, because all of our brainwashing, all the way through my training and all through medical school and advanced training, had been that brain damage wasn't really going to get better much. And, you know, that's just cerebral palsy doesn't go away. I mean, the experts are still saying that there's no hope of a cure for cerebral palsy. But fortunately, neuroplasticity came along, and most people now understand that brains grow and change and learn throughout life. And if our children are not progressing, then we have to look at what type of therapies we're giving them rather than blame it all on their brain not recovering.
Right. So that's a really interesting point you bring up. And it was one of the things that I think I find quite, you know, challenging to get the balance right, where there's always new therapies and new ideas that are coming forwards. How do you judge what would be a good therapy to follow or give a try to, or send your patients down that route, and which ones are going to be just the pseudoscience, there's a big hype around them, and then they peter out?
Yeah, you asked me that, and you also asked me to think about, you know, what I would say to therapists about changing their practice or doing things, and they sort of relate. I think you have to be open to new ways of doing things. We can talk about it later when we talk about the GMFCS, but I think there's data out there that shows that the way we're doing therapy is not necessarily the best when we look at the long-term outcome studies. So how do you know what's new and what's chasing a rainbow? Well, I think the most important thing is to know what works in your hands. What do you do with your patients that makes a difference that you can measure, that you can actually say, this child did this 6 months ago and he's doing this now, and what I did made a difference? Then you learn the new. And I found that most doctors and health professionals and pediatricians and therapists only bother to learn the stuff that interests them. So learn what interests you that's new and try and figure out how you would integrate that into your practice. In order to do that, one of the judgments that I ask people to make is, if you're thinking about going and taking a course, can they tell you what this course is going to give you? What are you going to learn out of it? And then you have to take what you've learned and go back and integrate it into your practice. You have to know what the new technique is adding to that in order to be successful at it. What I've found, and I think doctors are almost as are in the same boat as therapists, is what I call the butterfly syndrome. Butterfly syndrome is, you know how butterflies go and they sort of come and they pop down on a flower and then they go and they pop down on another flower.
Right.
What a lot of people do is they go off and learn a new technique and they throw everything else that they've ever learned out the window and just do the new technique. And that doesn't work. They're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And they're making another big mistake because they're, you know, most competent teachers will teach you what the limitations of a course is and will say who it should work with and who it's not going to work with. If they don't have entry and exit criteria, then elimination criteria, then they're really not ethical. But what happens is everybody goes back and they only want to do the new thing. And you can destroy any new therapy that way. I mean, I've had people who've gone to the pediatric kinesiology courses, particularly ones that are really done by my friends Trish and Audrey, because they get so enthusiastic and so keen on it that they basically tape the kids up so far that they can't open their mouth to eat, you know? And, you know, Trish and Audrey don't teach that. They teach, you know, doing it in a stepwise manner and doing it for specific indications and things like that. And that you continue doing what you already know works. But I think that's the problem. And, you know, you can't get away from the economic benefit. I mean, the people who are teaching courses because they're making money. And, you know, that it's just common for people to say, do it my way. And my way is better. But of course, they're not there 3 years later when it hasn't turned out to be quite so perfect.
Yeah, and sometimes the message or the technique gets kind of diluted or lost in translation. And that's when it starts to also look ineffective.
That's right. Well, I think the ineffectiveness is largely because of poor selection criterion.
Right.
You know, for example, I'm a really big proponent of the cage therapy.
Yes.
I think it does really well. And there's a lot of people who are doing cage therapy on 3-week intensives, which again, I agree with is really good. But the problem is, and you could substitute cage therapy for surgery in here. The problem is the kid goes off to do the 3 weeks of intensive cage therapy and they're completely out of shape. They're so weak, they can't move. And so the first 10 days of the cage therapy, they're petering out with fatigue after an hour and sleeping the rest of the time and waking up feeling that their muscles are sore. So it's not an effective method. So one of the things that I try and teach people is to, if you're going to do something like an intensive strengthening program, great idea, but don't waste your money. Work with your therapist to get some general fitness, some improve the cardiovascular fitness, improve the overall strength, get them in the best possible shape to go and learn how to do a new thing and to strengthen new muscles. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
That's where water therapy comes in. It's not really therapy, it's exercise. And so one of your questioners asked if the wet vest was paid for. You know, frankly, it's about $150. It's not a lot of money. And if you look on the web, you usually can find one that's a used one because they're absolutely indestructible. Or you can use it with your child, and when your child finally outgrows it, you can sell it to somebody else. But that flotation device allows you to get a child in the water moving, developing better respiratory function, developing overall body strength. And they get ready. So I sort of recommend if you're going to do surgery, do this as pre-op. If you're going to do an intensive, do this as pre-intensive.
Yeah. So do you actually go around and watch the children that you see actually having therapy?
Yes. I did it for about 20 years. I always did it in my own follow-up clinic when I was still at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. and I would see the babies in the unit, and then I'd see the babies in follow-up. When I ran the McGee Clinic for those years, I always watched what the therapists were doing. And when I started training and doing workshops, and I did about 200 workshops all told, I was always considered to be a very odd doctor, because not only did I watch what was going on in the therapy centers, but I actually got down on the mat and worked with the kids.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I think throughout America, only Argentina in the South Americas, and most of Europe and Israel, I have watched how people do therapy. And it was one of those aha moments when I realized therapy is very different in the different countries. They are absolutely convinced in different countries that different things work than what we think of in where we are. I can already tell you from my one trip to Australia, where I also went into some therapy centers and looked at kids, that your general population is much more fitness and movement oriented than we are in North America. My impression of the two places that I went is that your therapists are much more like the Scandinavian therapists, which again, there's a whole culture of getting outdoors and moving and fitness, and it shows.
I'm actually in New Zealand, but some people consider that part of Australia.
Haven't been there yet, but I'm looking forward to it.
So in the Iona Novak State of the Evidence Systematic Review in 2013, she made it pretty clear that NDT was not supported in the care of children with cerebral palsy. But in your book, the majority of the therapists you mention are NDT therapists. And I would love to hear your thoughts and some of the discussions I'm sure you've had with them about insights into this apparent conflict.
Well, you know, this is the thing. I think Iona Novak and Nadia Badawi at the CP Alliance of Australia are at least 10, 15 years ahead of North America and in the way they're looking at what we're doing and how we're doing it. Nadia is a neonatologist, and they've got some really interesting new interventions with the babies that they're testing out and working equally. And I don't know New Zealand at all, but in Queensland, CP and Rehab Centre, Rosalind Boyd had really worked terrifically well to develop the CMIT method and to look at the brain changes, the neuroplasticity in action. And what I like about what they're doing is they're analyzing what we're doing. Some of the conclusions, and one of those conclusions is that NDT doesn't work, I disagree with. And the reason I disagree, Iona, who I know and like very much, concluded on the basis of the research that was available that it didn't work. Second point is the research that was available and the people who were doing it were not doing current NDT, which has evolved a bit. I mean, if you asked me if classic NDT way back when worked, I'd have to say no, it didn't, because it was very therapist dependent. Joan Moore, who's a friend of mine, one of those early ones, I just know a whole lot of really, really good NDT instructors, and they could work magic with their hands, but whether you could actually translate that to somebody else was really a question. But over the years, NDT is involved, and it doesn't have the sort of rigid do it my way or the highway attitude, and I really approve of it. I really encourage young therapists to take an 8-week course, because it will teach you systematic thinking. It will teach you how to actually look at what a child is doing and figure out what you can do about it. When I was teaching all those courses, I used to ask how many of them had been NDT trained, because I knew that it was going to be an easier teach to that group than the ones who had never heard of it.
Right.
But do I think that NDT all by itself is the magic cure-all? No, it isn't. Nothing is a magic cure-all.
Right, which is what you were saying earlier about the butterfly syndrome, where you kind of need to put all the tools in your toolbox and use them all when it's appropriate.
Exactly. And that goals that you're making for the child are going to depend on where that child is in terms of brain and body growth. Because you may set your mind and think that this is a goal for a child when he's 2 years old, and it has to be totally different when he's 4 years old. Because between 4 and 6, for example, your cerebellum starts really working. So Regardless of CP, no CP, every child's hand is going to improve between 4 and 6. P.S. There's a major new system that came online that controls fine motor movements. But, you know, your goals may have to readjust. You may have a child, and Ros Boyd has shown that in some of the CMIT trials. They were doing it very early on some kids, and they figured out pretty quickly that a child with a fisted hand, a palmer fisted hand, at age 2, they didn't respond to CMIT. But they're smart enough to not say, well, that's the end of CMIT, it didn't work. They brought those kids back and redid them between 4 and 6, and they found out they responded really well.
So it's about looking at your outcomes and what you're actually doing.
And figuring out, I mean, we know from adult work that it takes 3 to 4 years for an adult stroke to recover. Okay, for lots of recovery in the first 18 months, less over the next 2 to 3 years. But, you know, you've got 3 to 4 years of spontaneous brain recovery, regardless of anything. Well, if you apply that to a child, then you have to know that, you know, in those early 4 years, every 6 months, the child's got a completely different brain. You got to step back and look at your goals over again.
I really like the way you classify the age groups and the different expectations around those age groups and how it all relates back to what the brain is doing and where it's developing. I also found it really useful where you classified the two main windows of neuroplasticity around the sort of early 4 years and then again the early teens.
Mm-hmm.
I've often thought we should bring the teens back for therapy. And here in New Zealand, we kind of do the early intervention quite well. But by the time they get to school, it all gets handed over to the school therapists who have a completely different focus, as you mentioned in your book. Yeah, so the idea of taking time out to just do intensive with your teens is a great concept. Did you want to maybe expand on that a little bit more about what you think therapy should actually look like at that age?
Well, let's go back to the early intervention for a point. The whole concept of early intervention, when it was first started, was to improve cognitive results and parenting. And I don't know anything about New Zealand or how you do it, but I have to say that most of it is not lesion specific. Kids are sent to early intervention with developmental delay, which is a non-diagnosis. I've looked at the data, and you know, in North America, the majority of therapy is given for what I call lesion specific, i.e. your child has cerebral palsy, it's a left hemiplegia, we're now going to treat your left hemiplegia, is between the ages of 4 and 12. So they completely miss that first period of early intervention. And the CP Alliance of Australia is doing some very interesting work looking at really lesion-specific motor retraining in those early years of life, and they're already showing some very positive results. What is your early intervention like?
In New Zealand?
Yeah. Do they get bracing? Do they get splints? Do they get specific therapy?
Yeah, I think it varies depending on where the children are seen because, again, there's not a standard approach to training pediatric therapists. So it depends on the experience and the training. But most of New Zealand has child development services that get access to the very young babies. And the pediatricians here are really good at referring very young. So we often, in my centre, we get to see them before they even leave the special care baby unit. And we get to work quite intensively with them up until they start school. Which does include all of that very lesion-specific training, splinting, mm-hmm. constraint-induced movement therapy, if that's indicated. And we have a lot of flexibility in how we approach the treatment. So not having sort of standardized methods has pros and cons, really, because you can kind of, you know, go with your interests and with your training, and there's not somebody telling you what you can and can't do.
That sounds excellent. Well, I mean, I think that model has to be expanded to the rest of the world, because it's certainly not that right now.
Yeah, I picked that up in your book when I was reading it.
It's too little too late. And the people who are still writing about, well, we have to wait and see because we wouldn't want to make a diagnosis because it might be wrong, are wrong. Because, you know, if your child's at risk of having a developmental problem, the earlier you start working with it, the better it's going to be. Your question about the teenagers, I think, is really important because I mean, the point I make in the book over and over again is that those first 4 to 6 years and the 4 to 6 years as the child goes through puberty are the times when the brain is absolutely primed to learn. In puberty in particular, which, you know, girls have at least 2 years earlier than boys, so that also confounds things a bit. But during puberty, I mean, it's like a child, the child's on, an athlete on illegal drugs. They get growth hormone. They get steroids. They get everything under the sun. They are just little growing machines. My son used to come home and eat a loaf of bread, making peanut butter and jam sandwich every day. I didn't know where it was going, you know? So yeah. They're growth monsters, and their brain is growing. I mean, parents get mad at me when I say kids are getting smarter as they go through puberty, but they do. They get 40% more brain power, and it sometimes makes them, you know, really hard to get along with. But the point is, if you want to grow muscle and get stronger, do it in puberty, for goodness sakes. You've got all that endogenous help to any strengthening program. And, you know, if you just say, oh, no, you're just a little unsteady in your feet and we'll just pop you in a wheelchair, they get weaker. I mean, it's not rocket science to know that when brains are growing and when their bodies are growing is when they should be getting treatment, most treatment.
Yeah. So what?
What does it look like?
Yeah.
What does it look like treating a teen? Well, the first thing about treating a teen is changing their motivation, because none of them want to do any therapy at that point. They've done therapy for their entire lives and they still have CP and they don't feel that they're normal and they don't want to do it. So one of the things that I really focused on when I ran a rehab clinic was to give them an aha moment. I found EMG biofeedback to be very helpful. Some types of electrical stim are very helpful. But just showing a child that they actually could activate their wrist extensors and their hand could move is enough of a motivation for them to start doing the work that change requires. I think you have to look at the child, the teenager, from top to bottom, figure out what their goals are, figure out in your mind, what can you change fastest? You know, I don't know if it's the same in New Zealand, but in North America, people often set goals based on what they like doing as opposed to what the child needs to do. And I try and teach people to look at what's going to give you the biggest bang for the buck in the shortest period of time so that this child who's now got 10, 12, 14 years of therapy behind him can actually say, this works. I want to do this. So that's the first step. And then after that, you have to set up a one-year plan and decide, you know, what is your specific goal? How are you going to measure it? Is it achievable? You know, is it results-oriented and can you measure it in time? And I, you know, one of the tricks I do with them is when setting up their home training program is to get them to train like an athlete, to make a journal and talk about it. So, for example, say they're doing some closed circuit strengthening, you know, with a TheraBand or something like that. TheraBands are, do you have TheraBands there?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, the child may be so weak when you're trying to activate their mid traps that they use a beige, you know, like you want to have it written down when they moved from the beige to the yellow and when they moved from the yellow to the red and when they graduated to a blue. They've got to have some measurable sense of change. And, you know, you have to sort of write it out for them and have them tick it off. Short-term intensives really work well. I mean, how long is your summer vacation?
We have about 6 weeks.
Oh, we have 12 in North America. Isn't that ridiculous? Do you get more at Christmas time?
No, that's our Christmas time is our long vacation. Otherwise, the kids have sort of 2 weeks off 3 times a year. It's pretty short.
So in those 2 weeks, I mean, we have nearly 12 weeks, so it's great. In the summer, and I set up a summer training program for the kids, the teens, and, you know, their goal is going back to school, looking and acting in a different way. And it's very achievable in that time frame. You can do the same in a 6-week program without any question, and you can do shorter intensives during the holidays. Other than that, one of the things I've done in North America a fair amount is get people to communicate with their school and cut out some of their requirements. For example, if you've got a child who's 14 and is being considered as an Olympic hopeful, those kids train and they get modified school programs. If you've got a musical kid, they'll go and get modified school programs because they're practicing their other talent. And I write that sort of program for the children that need that physical therapy.
Yeah, that's a really good way. Yeah.
When you work on a modified semester program, I hate to make generalizing comments like this, but the vast majority of kids that I've dealt with over 40 years with cerebral palsy are socially immature. Would you agree?
Yes.
Yes? Yes. So if they go to college 1 year later, does it make a big difference?
Absolutely not.
No. So I do the short-term intensives until they're getting through to high school, and then I talk them into a one-year gap year where they take a year and grow up and actually learn how to work with their body. And a lot of that is not done by the therapist. The therapist is supervising it, but it's done by athletic trainers.
Yeah. That's really interesting that you say that. It just brings up one of the other things that I thought about in your book. There's, you know, the work with Professor Rosenbaum and Ken Child is very much about participation. And sometimes a lot of it is around participation over form. And I know you speak a lot about form before function in your book. And you give some examples of an adult who was doing the participation, doing the Pilates, but not actually seeing the improvement until they started to address the form before the function. But then at the same time, you gave another example of an adult who had been as a tourist to Europe and done a lot of walking, and that walking in and of itself had led to quite a lot of obvious improvements. So there seems to be either the form before function camp or the just go for it and participate and jump in camp, which certainly with the teenagers when they're doing, you know, going to the gym and just doing strength training sometimes works really well. But it would be good if you could talk a little bit about those two different approaches.
Oh, you really like doing the controversial ones, don't you? Well, human beings work just one way, whether you're a peak performance athlete or you're a kid with cerebral palsy. Form is important for good function, period. If a teenager is going to a gym and doing strengthening programs, the strength coach will tell him to improve his form first, not going for a heavier weight until the form is better, because they know that if you do high intensity activities out of form, you're going to damage yourself, period. I mean, it's just the body mechanics. It's how it works. So again, you have to break it down. Getting movement is good. If a child's been sitting by themselves in a wheelchair, that's not good. But, you know, you can't just from that jump into saying participation is the be-all and end-all, because it isn't. I think our job as supervisors of things is to look at what is their alignment when they're doing it. Okay. Use that strength training. Go to a good gym and ask them what is the most important part of strengthening. And they'll say strengthening properly, strengthening in good form, because they know that if you do something badly, all you're going to do is learn how to do it better, badly, better. And Nora is a good example. When you talk about her improving her gait by a young adult by walking in Europe, you got to break that down a little bit. She wanted to walk better because she had to. She wanted to get around. She wanted to see all those galleries and churches. So that was a really strong motivation to be able to walk. She was also deathly afraid of falling. And so she had to learn how to manage uneven cobblestones and all that stuff, which forced her to focus on what she already knew. By the time she went to Europe, she had at least 14 or 15 years of therapists telling her and teaching her how to walk well, right?
Right.
But she never practiced it enough. Now, if she walked in her old sloppy way of walking, she would have hit the concrete. So she, you know, see, she was being put in a position where she had to walk better.
Right.
The action of pushing function first, why it's truly wrong, is that if you look at the studies of adults with cerebral palsy, for example, 60 to 80% with CP as adults have chronic musculoskeletal pain as their most significant disability. When you ask them, when you do quality of life studies, there's several of them in the literature, if you look at them and you say, what inhibits your life? What's worst? What's the worst thing about your life? They say pain. Okay, that pain comes because they're functioning out of alignment. And we can't get away from it.
I 100% agree.
Christine, in my book, my adult who has chorioathetosis, quadriplegia, all four limbs involved. I had known her most of her life because my parents and her parents belonged to the same golf club. And I had watched her and knew that she could do more than what she was doing. But I was damned if I could get her to do it. She was very bright. She is very bright, very opinionated, very defined about what she wanted to do. And it wasn't until she fell as an adult and actually slipped her SI joint on one side and had significant pain that she thought, oh, well, maybe we should do something. Now, she was 34 at that point, and I would encourage people to look at my TEDx talk because Christine ended up being able to hit a tennis ball better than many. She could hit 20 forehand volleys in a row without trouble. She couldn't run around the court yet, but she was really, really doing well, and that was working with an adult. If you can con them into that aha moment where they can have a glimmer of a future that's slightly different, they'll work like crazy.
It's really a new way of thinking about cerebral palsy and the potential for progress that that they have, even in adulthood, that you can make such amazing changes.
Yeah, and it's not magic. I mean, can I give a comment of a really good therapist?
Yep.
If you look at www.sbs, so Sam Baker, samtherapycenter.com, Pia Stampe is a physical therapist who's incorporated a lot of my concepts, and she does a really short 3 to 5 day intensive that if you look at her results in and testimonials page, it's frightening how much change you can make with 10 to 12 hours of focused therapy. We don't see those sorts of changes in normal therapy because we see them for a 40-minute period, once or twice a week. And I always sort of, when I was teaching, I used to say, you know, I used to be a reasonably good tennis player, and if I played tennis for 40 minutes twice a week, my game would not improve, ever. There's no human way, because humans learn through intensive practice. And if you don't put in the intensive practice, you're not going to learn. If you look at the GMFM and the basis of this whole thing and look at the instruction guides, your therapists are instructed to score them on the basis of their usual activity. And once you've read my book, you'll realize that the usual recovery, the usual behavior is not a measure of potential for change or brain recovery or anything else. It's just what they do at that point. It's a habit. And, you know, they've shown that it's fairly stable over time until they start deteriorating. And the reason it's stable over time is they're measuring a deeply wired motor pathway. It's a habit, right? And you don't change a habit unless you actually go back and do it. So the GMFCS is nice, and I think of it in terms of telling me where a child is at that moment in time. And it means that when I talk about a level 2 diplegia, even though you're in New Zealand and I'm here, we're talking about the same level of involvement, right?
Right.
But it doesn't tell me anything about what I'm supposed to do to change that and how we should change it. And the new changes, I mean, if you looked at my little boy with the hemiplegia, he would score as a level 2 because he occasionally, when tired, used a cane, very occasionally, but he was unsteady in his walking and he wasn't great going up and down stairs, but he ran like the wind and he played soccer and kicked with both legs. What is his GMFCS level? He's well better than a 1 because he's competitive and he's better than the other kids that are his age. So I think it can't be used as an outcome. It's like a one time, where are you and your measuring habit? But you've got to figure out a new system of actually asking the parents, what can your child actually do?
Their best function.
What is their best function? I had a set of twins that I saw in California. Only one boy was affected, and he had a hemiplegia, and he had a really bad walk. And his mother didn't believe me when I talked to her about how much more improvement he could have, because he had never really shown any significant improvement. And then she sent me a video of him about a month later saying, I'm sorry, I'm going back to the therapy center and we're going to work on this different way of doing it. And I said, what happened? She said, look at the video. Well, his scout troop was doing something and they had to walk the flag in. And he was given the flag to carry and he walked beautifully. No limp,
right.
No problem holding on to a post, really heavy flag. It was there, but he had to be challenged in order to show it.
In your book, you do describe some kids or some adults or teens that were classified as GMFCS 3 or 4 and then moved up a level following the treatment.
Yeah, and but they didn't do it spontaneously. They, you know, I put those things in about changing it because, you know, as soon as somebody writes that, you know, this is what we expect for kids, then the insurance companies jump on it. So there are quite a few of the CP experts that are saying that this is predictive of outcome. And the problem with that is the insurance companies are saying, well, you shouldn't do therapy because you're never going to get any better than what you are now. The papers that I quoted are largely from surgeons who go in and do things like single event multi-level surgery. And if you've got a significant crouch to the degree that you only have limited household ambulation and it's improved and you now have an upright gait, you're going to change your GMFCS level. It's as simple as that. You change. And I put it in just to sort of encourage people to keep thinking about, all right, this child is a level 4 plus or a 3. What is holding that child back from being a 2? And if we ask ourselves those questions, seriously ask ourselves those questions, the answer is usually pretty obvious. And, you know, in terms of my way of thinking, the first thing that you have to change is alignment. I didn't ask you what you thought of my spasticity chapter, but, you know, one of the things that I do know is that, and most parents of a child with CP know, is that they get tighter every time they grow. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
Okay. So what's causing that? It's not the brain damage.
It's definitely the growth, and your explanation about the boys and girls and the difference in muscle mass and growth spurt was such an aha moment for me, actually.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. I love it when somebody likes my book. Just have your listeners try this out. Take a child, take a small child who's got increased tone, and you look at him and he's up on his tippy toes and he's, you know, got sitting with on his posterior pelvis and he's just, you know, got tight legs and he's got tight hands. Put him on his back and get him a toy that he really is interested in and assess his tone when he's completely out of gravity. Even better, ask the parents to sneak in when the child is completely deeply asleep and see how much tone they have, okay? And you prove by that tone comes with movement against gravity. And if you can show that the child's out of gravity, right, in the water or on their back, tone is pretty good, and it gets worse as they get up, then it's weakness that is the problem. And if it's weakness that is the problem, okay, they're stiffening up to try and support themselves against that gravity, then put them into supportive garments. I mean, the stuff that Billy Cusick does with the onesie and the little small babies is close to magical. And you don't need a randomized controlled trial to show that it works. You have a little child sitting on a posterior pelvis with tight arms, tight legs, and no head control. You put him in a onesie, and 10 minutes later, he looks like a completely different child. So I am a really strong proponent of treating the weakness first. And you can't, if the child's biomechanically out of alignment, you can't strengthen their muscles. So give them enough support that they're straight, and then strengthen them within that and gradually reduce the need for those supportive garments. And you can practice good motor movement in supportive garments or in kinesio tape. There's just countless numbers of things that you can do with them. But the key is to try and get rid of that reflexive spasticity first.
Yeah. So that brings me to one of my questions that I really wanted to ask you. You speak in your book about the conflict between the spastic muscle being the weak muscle and overpowering the antagonist. Most of orthopedic interventions weaken the spastic muscle. There's a few therapists saying the spastic muscle is the weaker muscle and we should actually be strengthening the spastic muscle. We should be focusing on strengthening gastroc soleus and, say, hamstrings. Judy Carmick spoke a lot about this in the interview I did with her, and Lisa Passard coined the phrase, no poison, no knives. And you speak a lot about doing the Botox and doing the surgery in your book, so I'd like you to just speak around that and what your thoughts are.
What I was trying to get across in that in the chapter on spasticity is that many, many, many people, physicians, surgeons, and therapists in this field have chosen to focus on only one part of the complex interaction between the brain and the body in the growing child. The truth is that whenever you intervene in that feed forward or the feedback side of the cycle, you can have an effect. So you can have an effect by strengthening a muscle. You can have an effect by weakening muscle. You can have an effect by doing afferent sensory stimulation. You can have an effect by doing Botox. You can have an effect by doing an SDR or doing a baclofen pump. But I guess you asked me earlier about an aha. One of the other aha moments that I had was when I realized that every child that I sent in to orthopedic surgeons to have specific realignment, and more particularly when the single event multi-level surgery came in, is that I would see a child going off to surgery who had spasticity. And they would come back from surgery and they did not have any spasticity. And that was really interesting. And if you really think about it, every kid who has had good orthopedic surgery has got less tone because you've gotten rid of the alignment problem. You know, the surgeons aren't cutting any nerves when they're doing that. Now, when I talk about the spastic muscle overpowering the weaker muscle, I'm focusing basically on the feedback cycle of what happens when you have a muscle constantly firing, as in spasticity. And what it does is it reflexively inhibits the antagonist muscle. So there's that reflex inhibition, which is contributing to the elongation and weakening of the alternate muscle. And that is so pronounced in some kids when they're a little bit older. You try and get them to activate Tibant and they don't even know where it is because they need some activation of that part of the cycle. I don't say there's any one single way of doing it. I guess if I had to go right at the back, right at the very front of my thing, the first thing I do is try and make the child straight.
Alignment.
When they're young. Okay. But, you know, if you've got a kid who's a level four in a wheelchair, you've got to really look and say, what is the biggest bang for the buck and how am I going to do it? And that child is probably going to need surgery, plus or minus spasticity management, because a lot of the techniques that will work on a younger child just don't work on a teen. You know, it's figuring out. I don't hear any of the teachers talking, except Billy Cusick, talking about the age and stage of that particular child's body and function. Because I don't use Botox on babies and I don't advocate advocate Botox on babies unless it's a child who's cannot be helped with anything else. But it's really useful in the adults because you can get them out of their deeply ingrained motor pattern very quickly.
Yeah, that's really useful to clarify that.
The strength versus length issue is something that people don't pay much attention to. Every muscle in your body has an optimum functioning length at which it has capable of its highest strength. If that muscle is shorter than the optimum length, it is weaker. If it is longer, like the tib ant, which is elongated and inhibited, it is weaker. And that's just basic muscle physics. You know, you can't argue with it. It's the same in rat muscles as it is in human muscles. Short muscles are weaker than normal muscles, and long muscles are even weaker. So you got an alignment solves both those problems. It lengthens the short muscle and it shortens the elongated muscle. And that doesn't have to all be done surgically.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing with gastroc soleus when you put them in wedgies. You're gradually lengthening the muscle.
You speak like a physical therapist.
I take that as a compliment.
That's really good information. Karen, I might just ask you some of the questions that people have sent through.
Sure.
Okay, so the one question was, how can I learn the Eastern that you use to strengthen all the kids and adults you wrote about in your book? I'm a 40 plus years out of school and never used electro since PT school.
It's really hard because there's not very many good courses. I would suggest that they read a really good book on NMES, electrical stim. There's quite a few comprehensive textbooks that are in the, you know, predominantly in the adult world. I think the nighttime test program that I used, we're still looking for replacement equipment because it's just not available as yet. But, you know, the basic NMES is the same thought process from one to the other. Gadolon used to do a really good course. Judy Carmack has got her course. Susan Harrison's got her course. But, I mean, it's not been looked at, as far as I know, in a decent, comprehensive way of saying, how do we do this? And it's really sad because I don't know if you know this, but in Germany and quite a few places in Eastern Europe, electrotherapy is a subspecialty of adult medicine, that there's a four-year fellowship. And they have people in all their hospitals that are the electrotherapists who do everything from wound management to bone healing to treatment of spasticity. And, you know, there's just a huge amount of data out there. But in North America, we seem to be very unused to it. I mean, there's a great technique, EMG triggered stimulation, that I like better than TESS and I like better than NMES in any of its forms because it's a technique that takes the child's EMG signal and then augments it with a low-level stim so that, say, you've got a child with no wrist extension and they, you know, try to lift their wrist up and all that happens is their hand fists and flexes. So you put an EMG unit on, it's all an integrated unit, you put an EMG sensor on there. And don't tell them to move their hand, but tell them to look at the EMG and ask them to lift the line up or make the light go from yellow to green. And they start doing it. And when they hit the threshold that the therapist sense, then the contraction comes along. And now, the reason I like that particular technique so much, there's a lot of studies done on it in adults where they're getting hand function back in people who are 13 years out from a stroke.
Wow.
I mean, it's really quite terrific. It is neurofacilitated. You're helping the child's brain do something. So there's a positive feedback there. And it's fascinating because, you know, if you wanted to get a full fused contraction from a weak muscle with NMES, you might use anywhere from 20 to 30 milliamps. But with EMG triggered stim, you get a beautiful fused contraction with 10 to 12 milliamps because it's neurofacilitated. And I think that's, if I had one thing, if you're really interested in electrical stim, start looking at the adult literature and see what they're doing.
Right. Okay. The next question is, I've read your book and enjoyed it. However, you don't talk much about the more involved kids. Have you found that you've applied the same treatment ideas and seen improvement? Sometimes I feel like I'm not getting anywhere that matters with these kids except for getting them into equipment.
Well, I think that's a really common problem. You have to stop and ask yourself what you're doing and why you're doing it. You can change the more involved child. How far you're going to go is going to, this is going to sound terrible, but it's more dependent on how smart the child is than anything else. You cannot, there's some levels of brain injury that are so severe that you're not going to get much improvement. So my attitude is I go all out like crazy when they're young with the absolute expectation that they will improve. I think that most of the kids that are at level four can move to being a good level four or even a three. And at least half of the level fives. The older the child is, the more likely they are that we've got interventions now that they were never offered. But I think one of the things when I, you know, used to run a clinic and I'd see these kids, one of the questions I asked myself is, can I do this non-invasively? A lot of the kids that are level four and five have got such high tone, such a high degree of brain damage, that you really should think about spasticity management. And not, that does not mean trying to Botox every muscle in their body, but think about an SDR, think about a baclofen pump. I've seen magical changes in kids if you get rid of that body habit. And the older the kid is, the more likely you are that you're going to have to think about something surgical. You know, if you've been doing therapy for 12 or 15 years and you haven't had a change that's significant enough, then you've got to start looking outside of your box and seeing what else could help. I had one girl who came to me who was walking with Lofstrand crutches when she was 16 and very high tone, lots of standing clonus. And she went out to Vancouver and had an SDR done. She, at that point, Paul Steinbach was the only neurosurgeon who was doing older people. She had 3 weeks of intensive rehab and she came back walking independently.
Wow.
3 weeks later. And, you know, that's more and more of the neurosurgeons are doing older kids because you're like something like an SDR, which I only recommend for the really, 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 really severe that have failed on other things. If you do it earlier, and they've tended to focus on doing it earlier, but those teenagers, boy, you can make a difference.
That's an interesting thing that you bring up because sometimes you want to do it earlier to get the most chance to change or form good habits, but it can also be done too early, perhaps?
Absolutely. The very beginning of SDR, it's one of the advantages of being old, you can remember all these things, is that they used to be a requirement that they had a good reciprocal movement pattern before they would do them. Now they're doing them before they develop any reciprocal movements, and sometimes they never develop them.
So what are sort of common mistakes that you see clinicians making in this field? And that would be therapists or doctors.
I think the commonest problem that I run into is a lack of focus, a lack of actually sitting back and asking yourself, what are you doing and why am I doing it? A second really big problem is shared goals. I can't tell you how many children I've evaluated over the years with quadriplegia who have 10 or more therapists working with them in North America. They have a PT, an OT, and a speech therapist. They have both the publicly funded and the privately funded. They'll have a private speech and a public speech, and neither one talks to each other. They don't work on the same goals at the same time. The therapists don't talk to each other. And this lack of communication, I think, is the most incredible thing. Like you asked me about how I'd like to change the world if I was God's sister, and what I'd like to do, that was a joke, come on, laugh.
I was just processing that being the sister part.
Okay, but how I would change the world is I'd say, okay, in this next year, with this child who's got quadriplegia, what are our foci of development? And quite frankly, I would be working on gross motor skills, trunk control, all those sorts of things from the spring through the summer, whatever it is in New Zealand. When you can get outside, when you've got all sorts of alternate ways of doing it, when you can get into the water and use the wet vest. And during the school year, I'd be focusing on speech and upper limb function. And then everybody has to work on it. So even though the OTs take care of the hands and the PTs take care of the feet, everything meets at the trunk. Like, think of what would happen to a child who's got 4 to 6 different interventions a week if everybody did something about the trunk. And all those things about the trunk were the same. And what if the parents went home and worked on the trunk? Because you can't improve hand function if you don't have a better trunk. Do you see what I mean?
Of course.
That's what drives me crazy. They're not doing it. So, and I get really, when I ran the clinic, I had such resistance from therapists that, well, I don't want to talk to them. They don't think the way I do. We don't have the right to have our own professional disputes stand in the way of the child actually getting better.
Is there a specific advice that you'd like to give to therapists besides the communication, obviously, which is really important?
Well, I think therapists do an incredibly good job. I think we have to figure out ways within our own funding structures to look at 3 to 5 day intensives in the future, because that's how children learn. An example I use for parents about intensives is a child learning to pull the stand. Well, they pull to stand and they fall down. And then they pull to stand and then they fall down. And they do it thousands of times before they can stand set stably. And all of our human motor skills, we learn that way. We practice a specific thing and we learn how to do it and then we integrate it. So the child who's finally gotten up on their feet and walks, takes a few steps, they will walk for a very long time. And then one day they say, oh, that's good enough. Now I'm going to practice running. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And we have to fit all our toolbox into that thing that we have to, on a 3 to 5 day intensives, a bit more if they're more severely involved, you can make a significant change in function. And then you let the child out of therapy and give the parent some homework to work on that new skill and let them integrate it, then bring them back and do another one. But this seeing them for 20 to 40 minutes, 1 or 2 times a week, is just silly.
I think that would be ideal to work towards that kind of approach, which is what they do in the cage therapy, isn't it? They do a lot of that sort of really intensive work.
Yeah. Now, in terms of being a better therapist, I think they should read my book. How's that for self?
Well, I think that reading your book and reading your blogs is important.
Thank you. But I would also recommend How Doctors Think by Jerome Groopman, Groopman. It's a brilliant book. He's a New York Times writer and a knowledgeable cancer doctor. And he wrote about how doctors think and what they're hearing when you're talking with them. And it really teaches you how to communicate better. It's really a great book. The other one is that I always recommend to people is The Checklist by Atul Gawande. That's Atul, capital Gawande. It's, again, it's a fascinating book to read. He talks about, he's the guy who developed checklists for surgical patients so that they didn't leave sponges and clamps and scissors inside people's bodies. And he's gone on, he's a brilliant man. He's written a couple of other great books, but that one I think we need to read because we need to develop checklists in rehab. And the example that I use for that is contracture formation. Very few parents that I've talked to over 40 years know that spasticity gets worse with growth. And they don't measure their child's growth rate. And they don't report to their therapist or to their surgeon when the child is going into a growth spurt. If you had a checklist, you'd measure the contractures. You'd look at it. You'd notice it. And if you read the book, you find out that every single specialty has been improved when they add in checklists. But think about what it would be like if you actually could treat the child earlier, just as they're going into a growth rate, rather than at the end of the growth spurt when they need to have surgery.
That's really a good recommendation. I think you mentioned the How Doctors Think in your book, and I think that was one of my questions that I was going to ask you, is when therapists are dealing with doctors, if I guess it's doctors or other therapists that have differing opinions, because you've obviously come across that a lot in your work, where you've come up against roadblocks. But, you know, a good way to address that in a positive, useful way.
Well, I found the most useful way of doing it is telling them what your goal is. What do you think is the problem? What are you going to try and do? And how are you going to try and do it? And then, you know, it's sort of common politeness to say, do you have any input on that? In my experience, most people don't do that. And if you read the book, you'll find that most people make up their minds very quickly and then stick to their concept. It's called confirmation bias, that you stop seeing anything except the things that confirm your biases. So that's why I think reading those two books, How Doctors Think and Checklist, gets you to realize that it's not awful orthopedic surgeons who have no respect for therapists, and it's not terrible therapists who have no respect for orthopedic surgeons. I'm role-playing each of the two sides of the argument. It is people who've got different mindsets, different ways of looking at things. And if you understand that, then you can get better communication.
Thank you. Who do you currently consider noteworthy and important to pay attention to right now?
Well, I said the CP Alliance of Australia. The work they're doing in neonates and young early intervention is absolutely stunning. And there's going to be a whole lot more of that. The Duke University Stem Cell Research Group are really good, and there's going to be magical things coming out of there in the next couple of years or more. And really just keeping track of what's going on in brain imaging, because as we're learning more and more about how the brain works, it's fascinating stuff to find out how the brain is actually working, but it also, I find, it gives me a boost to know that there are people who are actually working on changing brains.
And then just a final question is, what can therapists do to develop excellence in the rehabilitation of neuromotor development and childhood disabilities?
Go and spend some time with the other specialties. I could ask you, you're a physical therapist?
Yeah.
How often have you gone with one of your clients to see the OT? How often have you gone with your clients to see the surgeon? And how often have you gone and spent a day in an orthopedic clinic day? I mean, unless you see how people work, you don't really understand how to communicate with them.
I think we're very lucky here in New Zealand, because we work in close teams where we get to do all of that on a day-to-day basis. But I can imagine if you're working in isolation that must be quite a tricky one to manage.
Yeah, I think one of the best ones that I ran into in the United States was Easter Seals, DuPage Easter Seals outside of Chicago. Every single child had a PT and OT and a speech. And if the child didn't have a speech defect, they worked on cognitive and motivation and other skill sets that they were also very competent with. That core of three took care of every child. And then they had once a week, they'd have a brown bag lunch with all the therapists, and they talk about their problems. And they got the input from the entire 40 therapists at one time. And they just did great work with their kids.
Sounds amazing. We have the opposite here in New Zealand, actually. We have something called a visiting neurodevelopmental therapist, who is supposed to do the job of all three disciplines on their own, to limit the amount of professionals coming into the family's lives and sort of giving conflicting advice. So it can be an OT or a physio normally, or a speech therapist, and they are supposed to do the OT, PT and SLT.
How do you think that works?
I think that it's a big ask to expect somebody to be a a specialist in all of those disciplines. And often it lands up, you focus on your discipline because that's what you know best. And the other stuff you do as best you can. So I think there's a place for it, but I think I prefer the other model that you were talking about, where everybody has a sort of comprehensive care and coverage so that nothing gets missed.
Yeah, and I think I often use the example of a child with type 1 diabetes that, this natural environment movement and not medicalizing the home and blah, 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 blah. You can tell what I think of that. I think is garbage. And putting all of it on one person's head, I think is garbage. Because, I mean, the point of fact is that we are downplaying the importance of having a chronic neurologic problem like cerebral palsy. It's a problem. It has to be dealt with as a problem. It requires work. It requires changing your schedules. You cannot make it nice. You know, there's stuff to be done. I use the example of type 1 diabetes. You've got a small child who's type 1 diabetic. They're going to be giving shots to that child 3, 4, 6 times a day. They're going to be taking blood samples the same number of times. They have to watch every single crumb of food that goes in that child's mouth and know that if they go off to a kid's birthday party, they could come back in ketoacidosis and die. I mean, nobody says, oh, I don't think we should be using insulin, or I don't think we should be testing them, or I don't think we should insist on controlling the diet. And, oh, I don't think we shouldn't make them exercise because that's not nice. Those are things that are necessary. And there are things for a child with cerebral palsy that are necessary. And trying to paper it over and not say that it isn't a problem, I just don't think it works.
Yeah, that is. If you were on video, you would see me smiling because, as usual, you just always have a fantastic way of really just putting things in perspective.
Thank you. I'm getting tired, so I'm getting grumpy.
Oh, no, I like the grumpy. I like the grumpy. And Karen, I think that has been such a brilliant conversation. You just have so much knowledge and insight and just a fantastic way of looking at things that make it so logical. I think that's the biggest benefit that you bring is just that real down-to-earth logic of what is actually needed and what it all means. So I really appreciate that you have taken the time to come and share some of that with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I do love your blogs.
Oh, thank you.
But you're making a difference. And I mean, I think that's what I so admire therapists, because they get up every day and they go to work and they make a difference. And I think one of the things I should leave this with is, you know, a series of being really quite optimistic about the future. We have got so much stuff available to us now. It's just a question now of motivating ourselves to be just a touch more organized.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you very much.